Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon with our favorite expert, Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. And always great to have Gordon here. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also check in online. Visit the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop, to see all the different ways you can get in touch with us on the World Wide Web. You can do the Facebook, you can do the Twitter, you can email us. Any way you want to connect, it'll get through. But the phone number always works as well, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, nice to have you here.
Good afternoon. Good to be back.
So this rich buddy of mine down in Jersey, he fancies the German sports cars, and I saw a picture on his Facebook yesterday of a Porsche 911, beautiful car, silver, and the caption underneath perplexed me. It said, "The last of the air-cooled," and I assume that means you're cooling the engine with air, but it has no radiator?
Correct. Yeah, that car, and I'm not sure of the year, but Porsches in the early years were air-cooled, just like your lawnmower.
Right.
The engine had a fan on it, and it blew air over the cylinders and over the cylinder heads, and that's how it kept cool, where a more conventional approach was to have the engine encased with water or coolant.
Yep.
Then it went through a radiator. And the fresh air or the air going past the radiator and being drawn by the fan cooled the engine. So it was an old design, very few moving parts, and there's no cooling system issues, but not very efficient anymore.
So, I mean, will it cool the engine just as well as modern technology?
The engine, it's hard to keep an air-cooled engine in its optimum operating temperature because it's just harder to control the air.
Yeah.
Where with a liquid cooled system, you have a thermostat and that regulates the water flow and keeps the engine wants to be at a certain temperature. That's when it performs the best. So the temperatures varied way high on those cars in super hot weather. And if you drove them in the winter, they ran too cold.
So are there any advantages? Maybe are they lighter?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah. Yeah. Porsche were performance-oriented cars, and it was a much more lightweight package. And the early ones, the engines were in the back of the car, so you didn't want a heavy mass of engine back there.
Interesting. 1-800-348-2551. Well, enough about my friends. Let's go to the phones. Bob and Kinderhook, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Yes, guys, you have a wonderful show. I listen to you every month. It's absolutely great.
Thanks a lot.
Gordon, my wife's looking to buy a used car. She's looking at an 08 Mercury Sable, 70,000 miles on it, and we're wondering if you have any history of what the repairs have been for that type of car, if there have been a lot or transmission or any other issues.
I think those cars got pretty good by those years, and the Sable and the Taurus were the same cars, neck and neck, just different packaging and different look. I don't think there's any really major problems that I'm aware of with that car. Is this an all-wheel drive that you're looking at?
I don't know. I should find out. Stupidly enough, I don't know. I think it is, though.
Well, I know the Taurus of that vintage became available in all-wheel drive, and it was a Volvo-derived system because in those years, Ford owned Volvo, so they shared technology and they even shared components. And it's really a pretty good system. So I can't point a finger to anything nasty on that car. I can't say there's serious transmission problems or constant head gasket issues, things like that. So other than getting that car checked over nicely, look under it to see if there's any corrosion or rust starting anywhere, but I think you're all right there.
Okay.
Yep, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. You know what I saw the other day, and I swear I haven't seen one of these in decades, was a Fiat. It looked new. Are they back?
Well, was it that new little tiny?
Yeah, it was a very small car.
Yeah, Fiat 500 is back, and there's a dealer right here in Albany, and Fiat now much to the chagrin of a lot of traditional Dodge Chrysler fanatics, but Fiat owns the Chrysler Corporation now.
Oh, really?
So you're seeing a lot of blended vehicles.
Now, didn't Daimler, wasn't that a German-owned company at one time?
In 1998, I believe it was, Mercedes-Benz, which was a Daimler-Benz,
yeah.
It was called back then a partnership or a merger.
I see.
But really, Mercedes-Benz was the stronger of the two, and they really controlled and owned it.
Yeah.
And then they tossed them away here some years ago.
So Fiat now owns the Chrysler.
I think it's the majority shareholder. I don't know how much of it they own, but I think it's quite a bit.
Interesting. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Harriet in Woodstock, you're on.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I know you've answered this question before, but I have to confess I don't remember what you said. So I have a Honda CR-V 1998, and I love it. It's wonderful. It has not much mileage. It's under 90,000 miles. It makes this awful noise when I turn the wheel, like a grinding. I know what it is. It's rust on, I guess, the brake pads. They've looked at it, they've examined it, and they said that's what it was, and they couldn't really fix it. And I'm just wondering how. It sounds so awful that it seems like it's doing damage.
Yeah.
Also, my question is, when it's wet, as it has been, the noise is horrendous, and it even I can even hear it when I'm just driving straight and not turning the wheel.
Oh, boy.
And then, as soon as it dries out, the noise goes away.
Well, let's assume that it is a rust buildup, and it's between the brake disc and maybe the shield behind the disc. If that's what your shop has determined, it can be remedied. But what's got to happen is, and I'm assuming, let's say it can happen both front and rear, although your 98 probably has drum brakes in the rear. So let's say it's coming from the front. Replacement of the brake discs or rotors is usually necessary. And when those brake rotors are off, any area that they come close to needs to be cleaned up and the rust ground off or knocked off or out of the way to allow enough room in there for everything to turn and not be hitting the rust. So it is solvable, but it's basically like doing a complete front brake job.
Mm-hmm.
But if it drives you that crazy...
It doesn't. It just sounds like it's sounds really bad.
Yeah, I know the sound, and it does. Sometimes it sounds like something's ready to completely fall apart in the front end.
Yeah.
So,
but why does it? Like today, a beautiful sunny, dry day, I'm not going to hear it.
Well,
but on a rainy, wet, damp day, it's very pronounced.
Well, if the car sits overnight, or if you don't drive it for 2 or 3 days, that rust builds up just from the moisture in the air.
Wow.
If it's very damp and or raining. During that period. So there's more rust, at least on the surfaces at first, that has to get cleaned up, and then it just kind of builds upon itself.
Yeah.
Would it benefit by being put in a garage?
Yeah, of course. Any car would like to be in a garage, out of the elements, off of the ground, particularly off of the grass. Things don't deteriorate and rust as fast.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, good luck, Harriet. Thanks for the call.
Well, thanks. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. Now, let's get one more call in before the first break. Robert in Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Yeah.
Hi.
Still talk. Yeah, hi. I've got an 02 Jeep Grand Cherokee, and I got a vacuum leak. I had a smoke test done the other day, and the leak is at least one cracked hose coming out of the rear left wheel. There's a metal box back there where the evac canister is and a diaphragm.
Yes.
How do you get at it? I spent all day yesterday trying to get at it, and I don't see any way to get access in there, or at least nothing very easy.
Yeah, what you're experiencing is very common on that vintage Jeep. The hose material tended to crack pretty readily around that EVAP canister and the lines that go in and out of it. And changing those, I imagine your check engine light's probably on.
Yep.
Yeah. To answer your question, how to get at it, ideally on a lift, which most homeowners don't have.
I had it on a lift yesterday at my mechanic's place, and they were pretty baffled by it.
What year is the Jeep again?
02.
02, yeah. I mean, we've encountered these various times, and as I recall, they are tough to get to. And I can't remember if something had to be moved out of the way, if taking the left rear wheel off gains access to it. But you got to get in there at that canister, and you'll find that probably every one of those hose connections has cracks in it. And you can just... replace it with you know, bulk hose. You can trim off pieces and
yeah, I already bought gas line hose, and it's a lot better.
But there's no secret at how to get
at it.
Yeah, there's no real secret. It's just you've got to gain access to it either by taking the wheel off or some shields or something back there.
So you need a map to know where they are. All right, Robert, thanks a lot. We got to take a break. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. More automotive insight on the way.
Comes from Chester Wood, Stockbridge, Massachusetts, presenting their annual Contemporary Sculpture Show featuring 26 artists, benefit reception June 22nd from 5 to 8 p.m. Chesterwood.org. Healthy Living Market and Cafe, featuring the Divine Wine Store with wines from all over the world with pairings, monthly tastings and events, healthylivingmarket.com. Foresight Land Service, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, for 45 years offering civil engineering, land surveying, land planning and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and Eastern New York. ForesightLand.com. And The Alternative Baker, Rosendale. Artisan all-butter baked goods made from scratch, handcrafted lemon velvet cakes and egg sandwiches daily, where taste is everything. LemonCakes.com.
One 800-348-2551 is the telephone number, and the show is Vox Pop, and the guest is Gordon Fricke, and we talk automotive maintenance and repair once a month. It's that day. Let's go to the phones. Dick in Longmeadow, Massachusetts. Dick, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 2006 PT Cruiser with 63,000 miles on it. I had the battery replaced. It died. The original battery from 2006 died in mid-January, so I had that changed. But like a month and a half ago, I'm driving, and the battery light comes on. And nothing happens. The car functions perfectly. Everything goes great. So I drove it straight to my mechanic while the light was on. And he came out and was gladly. He tested the battery. He said, the battery's perfect. He said, while you're here, let me check the voltage regulator. So the voltage regulator is perfect. Then he said, put the air conditioner on, put the headlights on, and he checked it again. It's still reading like 14 and a quarter amps. So I'm just wondering why that light's on now. And then you'll be driving, it goes off, and it'll go off for 2 or 3 weeks, and then it'll pop on again.
Yeah, that warning light you're getting on is a little bit deceiving, because when it says battery or BATT, people automatically think, oh, I got a battery issue, but it really should say charge. It's a charging system indicator. And that warning light can come on, and the system can check out okay, just like your mechanic found. It's very possible that the part of the alternator that is wired in to send the signal, whether it's charging or not, is having problems. And that the fault can lie in the alternator, even though it's still performing the way it should. But that's not to say that the system that senses it and turns the light on is not at fault either. So you're in kind of a catch-22 of, if you can't concretely discover what's wrong with it, you hate to start replacing expensive things.
Yeah.
And if it's not coming on that often, I think I would go longer with it.
Right.
And let's say you get to the point where the light is constantly on now.
Yeah.
Then really chase the problem down. Because the last thing you want to do is take the car on a trip where you're out of your normal range of driving.
Right.
And then it decides to fail, and then you need an alternator, and you're 100 miles away from home.
Yeah.
And everybody's upset because you didn't get the car fixed sooner.
Another thing they did was he said, let me just check and see through the computer. You know, when they open up the car and go into the dash and plug their device in, and it was throwing no codes at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He did everything right. He you know, he checked your charging volts and turned on some loads to see if the alternator could handle all that stuff. It's still entirely possible it's an issue with the alternator.
Okay.
Could be the wiring that plugs into the back of it, too. There are other things to check, but
okay.
I think I'd let it go a little longer.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Cheap advice. That's good. Sarah in Greenfield. Sarah, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a 2007 Subaru Outback Legacy, and it's got two pretty big problems right now. Day one from when we got it, the headlights have been poor as far as, you know, shooting out ahead of you into the road. We've had them adjusted. We've tried different bulbs. We have them adjusted so high now that they'll make, you know, street lamps go out. and I'm just wondering, like, is this a history? I've tried to look online to see if there have been complaints about this. And the only thing I found was that somewhere along the line, someone thought there was a problem with the structure of the housing of the, you know, the lamp itself.
You mean as far as the ability to reflect the light out? Is that what they were talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. Like I've heard that it's kind of a cutoff.
It's funny you say that because I had somebody in the other day and they were talking about, I think it was the newest, it was either the latest Outback or the latest Forester, but the he was in the dealership for a recall. And he's not ready for a new car yet, but, you know, of course, the salesman saw him hanging around, so he's, come on over, let me show you what these new Subarus are all about. And one of the first things he mentioned, he said, the lighting has been improved. So I think you're not alone in feeling that the illumination or the lighting is not as good as it could be.
Yeah, I think it's terrible. And I think it's pretty poor.
And you've done everything you can do.
Another, like, out of a junkyard, could I get a different kind of headlamp to install? Is there anything else that would fit?
No, nothing would fit in there except that exact lamp. Now, you said you tried, you have brighter bulbs. Are they the silver stars? Do you remember hearing that term?
I think they are the silver stars.
Yeah. That's about the only option you have. How do the lenses look? Are they beautifully clear, you know, the outside part?
They're getting a little bit I don't know.
Foggy looking?
Haze?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the majority of your problem at the moment. You need to get those buffed.
How do you do that?
Well, there's a process, and we do it at the shop, and you basically are sanding the headlight lenses with very, very fine sandpaper, and then you reduce the grit of the paper to ultra, ultra fine, and then the final stages are buffing it to a shine, just like you'd buff the exterior of a car.
Yeah.
And Pat at the shop does these, and they come out. If the inside of the lens is not foggy, they'll look brand new. It makes the whole front of the car look new.
What if the inside is foggy?
Then you can't do anything about it.
Can't take it off and do it?
You can't go inside the lens. But normally, it's always 90% of it's on the outside. And you definitely need to have that done because you'll notice a major difference.
You know, there was every now and then at night you see an ad for this miracle stuff that clears the lenses.
Yes.
And is this legitimate?
Yes, but it's very temporary because that's just it's basically like a dressing. You know the stuff you put on tires to make them shine and look good?
Yeah.
Almost the same product. And what it does is it temporarily goes into all those little crevices and imperfections and temporarily smooths them out and shines them up. but after some driving and some rainstorms, they're back to being hazy again. So that's very temporary.
Okay. All right. Well, Sarah, good luck with that.
I have one more question. Another big problem is that we have a dead animal in the same car. We have torn apart the dashboard, checked out the vents as far as we could, checked out up to the fan as far as we could. Somebody has suggested the animal may be under the carpet. I mean, this has been stinking for probably more than 2 months now, and I thought the thing would have dried out and not smelled anymore.
Yikes.
But it does. So as far as it being under the carpet, where would you check for that? Where would you tear up the carpet?
Well, let me ask you this first. Did somebody remove the blower motor, the heater blower motor?
We didn't remove it. I think we got up to it.
Yeah, have that blower motor taken out. That's more than likely where this carcass could be. I doubt it's under the carpet. That is, there's no room under there. I mean, if it is, then you've just got to really start taking the carpet up from where you feel the smell is coming from. But take out the blower motor first. You might find a mess in there.
All right. And is there kind of, like as far as the vents opening and closing, is there a vent that it could have gotten stuck in? Or, you know,
it's a
door that opens and closes?
It is possible, but it's a lot of work to take all that stuff apart.
Yeah.
But if you take the blower motor out, you got a pretty big opening there. You can now look around with a flashlight where that blower motor is sending the air, and that's the biggest area. That's usually where we find mice and things like that.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks
a lot. I appreciate your advice.
I appreciate that call.
Bye.
More than you know. Let's go to Robert in the Catskills. Robert, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, Gordon. I have a little bit of a problem with my caddy. It's a 57 Coupe de Ville.
Oh!
And it's got a big block, 472, and everything works on the control systems, but it leaks water from if I turn the heater on, so I bypass it, obviously, with that little, you know, bypass hose on the block.
Yep.
But it's got two lines, you know, three-quarter inch lines coming into the heater core. You can see it below the fender. The problem is the leak is on the passenger side. And as far as I know, there's nothing over there as far as liquid.
You mean the heater core housing is
on the driver's inner fender, basically.
Yep. So the heater core is really not in the passenger compartment.
Right. But that's where the water comes out in mass quantity.
And it is antifreeze.
Yes.
Okay. Well, what's probably happening is the way that housing is built, even though the heater core might be out towards the engine compartment, that housing, because it's the air needs to get blown into the passenger compartment, that coolant is running in there as well. I think what you should do is expose that heater core. And I don't think it's that nasty of a job on that car, is it?
Well, I think you got to pull the fender halfway off for some reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, 57s have the worst brakes and, different situations with them.
If it's antifreeze coming in and it stops when you turn the heater valve off or bypass those hoses, you've got a heater core leaking and or the connections that go to it. But those, I believe, are outside where the hoses slip on.
Yes, you can see them under the car, almost down towards the master cylinder.
Yeah.
I might try to just run a different set of hoses and see if something happened there. Is there an orientation? Because there's two, titties coming down, left and right. Does it matter which side you put the hoses on, which way it goes?
You mean, does the heater core care which way the water flows through it?
Right.
No, not in a car like that.
I didn't think so.
I mean, nowadays, your car is old enough to where there's probably a heater control valve that just shuts the hot water off.
Right, all the control valves on, all the controls on the dashboard still work. If I hit the thruster and the fans, it all works.
Yep. Yeah, I think you're going to find you got a heater core problem.
Yeah, it's a bit of a trouble. That's what I was figuring. I was hoping it was a faster fix. And the next question is, do you do kingpins?
Not really, because it's such an old...
What's a kingpin?
It's something that I didn't really encounter much of, because cars had already switched over to ball joints. Kingpin is what allows the front wheels to do the
steering. It's the predecessor of ball joints, basically.
Yeah. And it's basically...
My 39 Buick needs kingpins, and I can't find anybody who's willing to do it anymore. Any guy with gray hair.
I was going to say, you need to talk to somebody that works on medium and heavy-duty trucks, because those still have kingpins.
Oh, you mean like Central Spring up in Albany, that kind of thing?
Exactly.
Brilliant. Hey, how's the 57 run? I tell you what, I would love to see that thing.
It's, well, I have 14 cars. I'm strictly into the American hot rod thing.
Yeah.
And I got three big black caddies, 39, 69, and 57. I got a Hemi Chrysler. I got a 442, a Grand Sport. Got a Packard, a Silver Hawk, you know, that kind of stuff.
That's all big, powerful stuff, boy. You're not fooling around.
You know, but I'll tell you something, my C5 vet can beat any of them in a race.
Yeah, but...
It isn't the same as American Muscle.
No,
that's right.
You know? There's something about it. It's just classic stuff.
Hey, Robert, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Bradley in Richmond, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My fan belt squeaks. I have a 2010 Toyota Tacoma truck, and I've asked a few different mechanics about it. Some say put dowel soap on it. Some say Armor All. They also say that there's supposed to be an adjuster that will just adjust it so it stops squeaking, but I'm not sure what to do with it.
Sure. How many miles are on the truck now?
There's like 57,000, 67,000 miles.
And is this the original belt?
Yes. The original belt, 2010.
Yep. I
drive my truck a lot. It's my work truck. I remodel homes.
Sure. This is what I always do first when you think you've got a belt squeak, is I spray water on it with a pump sprayer and just shoot the water directly on the inside of the belt first.
Yep.
And don't go crazy. Just give it a couple squirts and see if the chirping immediately stops. If it doesn't, then spray it on the outside, the back side of the belt, see if it immediately stops. And if it stops from either of those two sprayings of water, on a vehicle of that age and quality, I doubt you've got any issues with pulleys or things going out of line or seizing. You might just plain old need a new belt. Because those belts wear, and when they wear, they can start to get noisy, and that's exactly what happens.
Yeah,
and you've got enough miles on it where it's. I mean, sometimes those serpentine belts, we see them on there for 70, 80, 90,000, but at your mileage, it would not be unheard of at all to replace it.
Okay, and then one other quick question. one of the times when I changed my tires over from regular to studded snow tires because I live in the Northeast, and when they changed them back, I had this little light come on. It looks like kind of the bottom of a tire, and I looked it up in the book, and it said that either air pressure or something was going on with the tire.
Yep.
So I brought it back to the tire warehouse, which is who changed it, and they said they couldn't, there's a thing to reset that, and they said it wasn't resetting. And I asked Jiffy Lube once, and they tried to do it, and they said they can't. They don't know what's going on. They can't reset it.
Well, here's what needs to happen, and that's becoming a very common event or problem. With your particular vehicle, each of your valve stems on your tires has a little sensor in it on the other side of it, and that tells the computer what the air pressure is, what the temperature of the tire is, or the temperature of that wheel assembly. Make a long story short, as long as your air pressures are all where they should be, and have you checked them?
Not only I've checked them, but I've had, just in case, I have a gauge and a compressor and all that,
yep,
in case I had to put more air in it, but they're exactly what is specified on the, if you open up the door, there's a PSI.
Yep, a label.
A bunch of different stuff, and yep, one of them is how much tire is supposed to be. So
sure.
I have checked them, and they seem fine.
Here's the next thing that you need to have done. You got to get it to somebody that's got tire pressure monitoring equipment where they can go out with a tool and go to each wheel and see if the sensors are all working.
Okay, and so I have to do like Toyota's.
Toyota or a shop that has that type of equipment, and a lot of shops now have this. I'm surprised Tire Warehouse doesn't, but here's what could possibly be the fault. I don't want to blame anybody, but it is not that difficult if you're not being extraordinarily careful to accidentally break a sensor.
Because
they're made out of plastic and they're inside the wheel. And
are they expensive to replace?
Not really. They used to be when they first came out. Now there's replacements out there that are in the $40 to $50 to $60 range aftermarket. Of course, the tire has to be dismounted, and then it needs to be reprogrammed. But that you need to get to the bottom of it, and that's what I would do. You might have a bad sensor or a broken one.
Is that a deal breaker when you have an inspection?
No, no, it's not on the inspection. It'll pass with that light on.
Okay.
Yeah, it already has once. And, of course, you know, I'm 53. I've owned a lot of cars. I've never had any sensors. I've always checked tires occasionally.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm addicted to these little gadgets, but
no.
Still it's there.
Well, the light will drive you. Some people, it would drive crazy. Other people could care less. It could be every light. It could be a Christmas tree on the dashboard, as long as the car runs.
Yeah, I suppose so.
It runs great. Other than the squeaky belt and that thing, it's been a pleasure having it.
Well, Bradley, thanks for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, let's take a break here. Zach the Engineer. We'll be back with more from Gordon Fricke on your car questions or trucks. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Oblong Books, presenting the League of Extraordinary Readers series for ages 8 through 12, featuring authors Ann M. Martin, Mark Goldblatt, and Jeff Rodkey. Saturday, June 22nd, 4 p.m., RSVP requested, oblongbooks.com. Four Seasons Natural Food Store and Cafe, Saratoga Springs, New York. Locally owned and operated since 1988, open 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., 7 days a week. FourSeasonsNaturalFoods.com. Glens Falls Hospital, serving 6 counties in the Southern Adirondacks and 28 locations. Big City Medicine, Hometown Care. Twitter, Facebook, and GlensFallsHospital.org. And Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York. Serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available. TheDamCafeAndDeli.com.
One 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. Automotive questions answered today on Vox Pop. Let's go to the phones, and it's Bob in Washington, Mass. Bob, you're on.
Yes, thank you. I have a similar situation to the Caddy. I drove 250 miles to get up here in the Berkshires and noticed under my athletic bag, which I have in the rider's seat, that the whole flooring on the rider's side was soaking wet. I had the air conditioner on some of the time in that 250-mile drive, and I'm wondering what it might be.
Yeah, Bob, that's a pretty common occurrence. The air conditioning system generates a lot of water. If you ever look at an air conditioner hanging out of a window, it's constantly dripping, especially on a humid day, because the moisture's being forced out of the air by cooling it. So that happens inside the dashboard of your car where your air conditioning evaporator is located. And there's a drain to carry it outside and let it drip on the ground. And those drains plug up after a while. They just get junked up in pollen and dust from all the years. And it's usually a fairly easy thing to do, is to clear that drain.
And how do I do that?
Well, it may be hard for you to do it yourself because it's under the car. And sometimes those drains are not very visible. Sometimes they exit under some plastic shielding. But you basically just have to... the best way to do it is, of course, to have the car on a lift. And then you can, especially after a hot day where the air's been running, you can kind of look up and see where that drain is supposed to come out. And if you clear it, sometimes you'll get a quart of water, a cup of water that pours out of it. But that's what you've got going on there. That AC drain is plugged up.
Okay, I'll get it to a mechanic and a lift. Thank you very much.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And I like the way the call screener has these on a hierarchy here. Let's go to Gary in Western Mass. Gary, you're on.
How you doing?
Good.
A little tidbit for the lady that called up about the dead animal in her car. I've got an old pickup that sits in my yard a lot, and every year I get mice in it, and I left a trap in it one last year, and it was a dead mouse in a hot summer, and it was really pungent. And there's this product at a company called CAR, C.A.R. products. It's a bomb that you set up in your car, you turn the air conditioning on and recycle, you let it run for a half hour, and you lower the window, shut the car off, and let it sit for a couple hours, and it absolutely gets rid of the smell of dead critters in your car.
Huh.
That's an excellent suggestion, because I know there's products that you spray into the vents from the outside, and that's more for air conditioning odors for bacteria. But this is for nasty odors like your like dead animals and mice.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean it was awful.
Tell me what it's called, because I've got an older car with a mouse smell that I've had in it for years.
Oh boy,
what is it? Bomb? Did you say?
Well, no. It's the company is Car C.A.R. Products. It's a national company. And if you just call them up and you tell them you want the fog or the bomb that you put in the car, and it'll eliminate odors.
Wow.
And it absolutely worked for me.
Holy mackerel.
That's Gary, thank you for calling.
You just
gave me great advice.
Thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Carolyn in Poughkeepsie. Carolyn, you're on. Hello, Carolyn. Oh, Carolyn's gone. I'm sorry, Carolyn. All right, that's it for her. We'll go over to Bill in Greenville. Bill, you on?
I am.
You're there. We're here with you.
Okay. The problem I've got is I've got a 96 Toyota Corolla, straight four-cylinder, you know, nothing fancy, that I've had a problem with the EGR for about 8 months now that we're chasing and can't figure out what the problem is. I keep getting a insufficient flow code. We've checked the solenoid. It was marginal with the voltage, so we replaced that. We had a diaphragm in the vacuum modulator that was bad, so we replaced that. The EGR valve itself holds vacuum, so that's good, and it falls out when you apply vacuum. And the passageway is clear. And we've done just about everything there is to do in the EGR circuit, yet I still keep getting this insufficient flow code.
Yeah, that's a common one, too, and you've done a lot of legwork on it. On EGR valves that have a vacuum control, which it sounds like yours has, in other words, the vacuum is what does the opening and shutting of that valve.
Right.
Okay, if you have that engine at idle, engine's warmed up, operating temperature, and you're idling, do you have access to a vacuum pump?
I do.
Okay. If you put your vacuum pump on that valve and very quickly pump that valve open, that engine should all but stall or will stall.
And it does.
It does. Okay, that you just checked the flow as far as it making getting the exhaust gases to go into the intake and it hits the engine, and you've done it so abruptly at idle that the engine just about quits. Are you sure that the system is being commanded on? And I know that's a tough question for you to answer, but if the computer commands it on and thinks it's on and doesn't see the results, it says we must have insufficient flow because it couldn't prove it.
Well, one of the things that I did notice was, according to all data, on the throttle body, there are three vacuum ports. And according to all data, I should be getting no vacuum below idle, and I should be getting vacuum on all three ports above idle. But the one port that goes to the vacuum modulator, I can't get vacuum out of. Now, I did go out and get another throttle body to replace it, figuring out it might be a clogged passageway or whatnot. We replaced it. The passageways are clear, yet I'm still not getting vacuum on, I believe it was the R port.
So you've got a vacuum hose that goes from the engine to the solenoid that the computer turns on and off to run the EGR valve, correct?
Well, it goes from the throttle body to the vacuum modulator.
Yeah. Now, do you have good solid vacuum at the end of that hose?
Well, that's just it. According to all data, I should be getting on a high idle or above idle, I should be getting vacuum on that port, and I'm not.
Are you sure those hoses are all on the correct way?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because the olden days, they ran the EGR valve on what was called ported vacuum. And you didn't get vacuum until the throttle was opened up probably a quarter or better. And
right.
And that's what you should check with a vacuum gauge. Put a gauge on it, and then with the engine running in park, start to open the throttle. And as you start to get past maybe a quarter of the way, that vacuum gauge should start coming up.
Mm.
And that's
right, which it does, except on the one port that I'm supposed to have vacuum on, according to the old data. I should be getting vacuum on a, you know, anything above a high, you know, an idle. And, you know, I'm bringing this thing up to 1,600 RPM, and that's the one port that leads to the vacuum modulator that I'm not getting vacuum on.
Just do a little experiment. Switch the hoses and try it.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot. I tell you what, that one, I have no idea what you guys were talking about. Caroline in Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about my clock in my car. I bought the car 2 years ago. It's a 2006 Honda Civic, and it's been losing time ever since I got the car. And I don't know if that's an indication of a battery problem or alternator, although nothing else seems to be amiss.
So the car continues to start and run properly. You're never having a dead battery or having to jump start it?
Nope.
But the clock loses time.
How much time?
Well, initially I noticed that it was about 10 minutes behind when I got the car, and I didn't think anything of it. And gradually it's worked itself up to almost 45 minutes in the 2 years I've had the car.
Ray, reset the clock.
Does this fall in the theory of relativity, or is that the
speed? That's for Bob Berman.
Or do we have to? We've got to reach the speed of light for that.
Exactly.
Okay. I wonder if it's just a faulty clock, because the clock is just tapped into your electrical system. It's getting voltage, and it's got a pulse device in there. I don't know if it's a quartz or a crystal or whatever, but that's how it keeps time. But basically, it's just grabbing power out of the car, and that's how it keeps time.
45 minutes over 2 years, though. It's not that bad.
No, it is, and I just wasn't looking for a larger problem, so I thought I'd throw it out and see what you got.
Saying. Yeah, so it's not indicative of something about to go really south on her vehicle?
No, I don't think so at all.
Okay, and I just one other quick question. In terms of octane ratings, a lot of times the manufacturers recommend that you use a certain octane rating. If you use a lower octane rating, are you damaging your engine?
Well, that's a very common question, and every time gas goes up, we get those calls about what gas to put in a car. If the manufacturer, the most cars that require anything more than your standard regular is 91, and that isn't the easiest to find because it goes 87, 89, and 93.
Right.
But most European cars and anything that's turbocharged tends to require premium, but it's almost always at 91.
Okay.
If you go to 89 from 91, I think the car can survive it, and there are features in the electronics that listen for pinging and detonation indicating low-octane gas. And it'll make adjustments to save the engine. You don't hear engine ping and knock anymore like you used to.
Yeah.
Oh, my boyfriend has a BMW, and he's always taken very good care of it. And his recommends 93, and he's putting in an 89. And he's only started doing that a year or two ago.
Yeah, I have a couple cars that require premium gas. And depending on the vehicle, I won't drop below 91, and I usually will treat the ones that really want the high test to whatever the car manufacturer recommends.
Yeah.
Because you're going to get the best performance out of it.
Right. Would it make a difference in warming up the car? Because they used to say, let your car warm up, and then someone told me recently, no, you don't have to do that with newer model cars.
Well, that doesn't really have anything to do with the octane of the fuel, because the gas is burning that gas at all times, so the warm-up really is not that big of an issue. But I would tend to stick with what the car manufacturer recommends for octane.
Okay.
Okay, and as a separate issue, should you let your car warm up?
The thought nowadays is not to let them warm up for a super long time, but engines are much more efficient today. They warm up much faster and pollute less. And it's not as detrimental as letting cars of the 60s and 70s sit outside screaming on high idle.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, really, when you're warming up a car, what are you getting? The oil flowing through the engine? Is that about it?
Well, yeah, you're going to get the oil warmed up and everything getting proper lubrication, cooling system up the temperature. All those metal and plastic and varying parts are expanding, and some at different rates.
Yeah.
You don't want to start your car up at 5 below 0 and then go out on the highway and put it to the floor.
Yeah.
That's really bad.
Yeah.
So yes, it's a good idea to let it warm up. Some manufacturers say 1 to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I let mine run a little longer in cold weather because I don't want to be up
in cold weather.
Freezing.
But in the summer, yeah. I mean, a minute?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Nick in Albany. Nick, you're on.
Hi. I've got a question about a 2002 Toyota Highlander. Our engine light's been on for quite a while, and when it first came on, I brought it to our garage, and we got a good garage, and they said, they checked it, and they said, there seems to be a little bit of gasoline vapor leaking from some sort of a vapor hose on the top of the fuel tank, and we noticed the smell of gasoline, especially when we completely fill the tank up. Now, they said, really, their solution is you got to replace that hose, and the hose is right at the top of the tank, and so the tank's got to come out, and to get the tank out, you got to take the rear end out. So I'm wondering if that does sound like it's the problem, and if it is the problem, is there anything else we can do besides disassembling the back of the car to get to this?
Hmm. Yeah, yeah, it very likely is the problem. What year did you say the vehicle was?
It's a 2002.
Is your shop concerned? Are things getting rusty under the vehicle?
They didn't say that there was a lot of rust under the vehicle, and it doesn't. If you go and take a look underneath, it doesn't look bad, but they said this line is right on the top,
yeah,
which is why you really can't get to it. They took the back seats out, tried to get to it from the floor, and
yep,
there's really no little, you know, inspection hole that you can get into.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, it really bothers me that so many car manufacturers don't have access panels above the fuel tank and above where the fuel pump comes out. They force you to remove it, and if it's an all-wheel drive like yours, it's a tremendous amount of work. And then you're going to encounter things that need to be fixed or replaced in that process that you may not even be thinking about. Other lines, stuff, the things that hold the tank in. So it is kind of an ugly proposition. So I understand.
Expensive
that,
proposition,
yeah,
too, right?
Yeah, but I've got a feeling that's the issue.
Yeah, right. And it's the car's been so good to us. It's got about 150,000 miles on it. Everything else seems fine. So we'd be tempted to just get it fixed, but we're probably looking at a $700 or $800 job at least.
Well, it could be. It could be really ugly.
All right, Nick. Thanks a lot for the call. Let's get another couple of calls in. Mark in Greene County, you're on. Mark.
I just had a quick question about the octane thing. Is this something I thought up that's totally wrong? Could you put would it work out if a car needed 91 octane to put in 89 sometimes and the 92 or 93 on alternate fill-ups? Would that average out, or is that just me with a crazy idea?
What about half a tank of each?
Well, Ray, you just hit the nail on the head. You don't even need me here.
Okay. Well, yes, I do.
Oh,
no, I think so. I think so.
Yes, if you put in half a tank of 87 and a half a tank of 93, you're going to get an average.
Okay,
and that's how it gets blended.
What, do you get a big spoon and stir it up?
Yeah, that's right. I'll just take it through some hard corners to shake it up.
Just drive it on a Greene County road.
Yeah.
Nice. Thanks, Mark.
That'll stir it up real well. Okay, hey, thanks a lot, guys. You guys are the best.
Appreciate it. Let's go to Christine in Albany. Christine.
Hi. I've got a 2000 Honda Accord that recently, it makes a noise when I'm accelerating. It's kind of like a grindy noise that happens sometime around like 30 miles per hour. It happens definitely if I'm kind of going up a hill. And if I'm really going up a hill, it'll be an extended amount of noise.
And does it stop the second you take your foot off the gas pedal?
Yes.
Okay, so it's totally linked to accelerating.
Yes.
Is it from the front of the car?
It sounds
or underneath
like
you?
I would say... I'm not sure.
Yeah. There's a few things that can cause that. It could be on the exhaust system on Hondas and a lot of cars. They have these spring bolts where the two pieces of exhaust come together, and that allows the engine to move around and still keep the exhaust system sealed. It's possible that one of those joints is getting rusty and going bad, and that could be what you're hearing. And you will hear it more so when you're hard accelerating because it rocks the engine forward and changes its position.
Okay.
Or it could be something, some type of an exhaust shield or something that's ordinarily not touching, but when you accelerate hard, the movement of the engine makes these pieces touch and causes the squeak.
Okay.
So it's got to go on a lift, and somebody's got to do some investigating.
Christine, we're out of time. I apologize, and thank everybody who called in today. A lot of fun. Gordon, always entertaining and informative. And we thank you for stopping by, and we thank everybody for calling in. Also like to thank Zach Malloy, who handled the controls. Brandon Holmes answered the phones today. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York, specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry, and gifts. JoyellesJewelers.com. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, for colorful roses, delphinium, phlox, veronica, yarrow, small fruits, and deer-resistant perennials, wardsnursery.com. Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors, currancompliance.com. At New York Electrical Motor Service, Glens Falls, New York, specializing in electrical and mechanical apparatus sales and service, a subsidiary of Applied Dynamics, NewYorkElectricMotorService.com. That's it for today. Moyers and Company tomorrow at 2. Next week, it's Medical Monday, and we'll see you tomorrow and have a great weekend. If not, we'll stay tuned now for a news update.